Hello everyone, you've reached episode 57 of Darling Why.
Well done.
Well done. You managed to listen to 57 of these.
Thank you for committing to us.
Thank you so much for committing to us. Once again, I am Louis, and for that I do apologise.
I'm Kay.
No apologies needed.
No, I'm great. The two words rhyme, that's how you know. No apologies needed. I'm unapologetically myself, Louis.
Speaking of things that don't need apologies, today we're going to be talking about Stop Making Sense, the 1984 concert film from the Talking Heads, which I mean, spoiler alert, we wouldn't be on this podcast if I didn't love it,
mm-hmm.
And I love this goddamn movie so goddamn much.
I enjoyed it. I saw it for the first time the last couple of weeks, and it was really, really good.
Alright, so, less dilly-dally, more talky-talky. sorry, I'm just being... dare I say I'm not making any sense.
Well done. Oh, very clever.
Yeah, so Stop Making Sense, filmed by the Talking Heads. It was filmed over a few nights for their tour for the album Speaking in Tongues at the Pantages Theatre in Los Angeles. So the film is directed by Jonathan Demme. Now, you may know that name. You may not.
Nope.
Well, you would know that name if you've seen the film Silence of the Lambs.
Which I have seen many times, yep. Actually. Did you direct that?
Yep.
Nice. That's a good movie.
Yep.
Hannibal Enthusiast Kate. That's a good movie.
Yeah. He also directed Philadelphia.
A movie I haven't seen, but mentioned last night because it's available for streaming on Now TV.
Yeah. So
he's done some big hits.
Yeah.
Hmm.
You could make the argument this is actually his most beloved movie. You could, if you're of a certain vintage and of a certain type of fan of music. But, yeah. So... brief history of the Talking Heads. I'm going to try and keep this very brief because we could be here for hours and I don't want to be. I'd like to get to the main event. I would like to get to the meat on the delicious bone. I would very much like to crack on. So Talking Heads, very brief history. The band consisted of four members: David Byrne, Chris France, Jerry Harrison, Tina Weymouth. They basically originally were formed in the 1970s. In 1974, three classmates from the Rhode Island School of Design, they all moved to New York City and they called themselves the Talking Heads. Byrne, France and Weymouth used the ironic sensibilities of modern art and literature to subvert rock and then embrace dance rhythms to alter it even more. After adding Jerry Harrison in 1976, the Talking Heads spent a decade moving from spare intimacy to rich pan-cultural fluency and then back again. The enormous popularity of the quartet's records paved the way for other rock adventurers. Their videos and film were also influential. That is a quote from Britannica.com. I didn't just make that up on the spot.
Well, about a third into what you just said, I was like, you're quoting. That's not you. You didn't write this.
I'm worried I sound a little bit Patrick Bateman.
That's not your
Bateman.
Writing style. Patrick Bateman talking about... what's that fucking band? God.
Huey Lewis
from the News, yeah.
Who may or may not make an appearance on this podcast. I don't know. It depends how
you
I
do
feel.
Like Huey Lewis from the News.
Four's a fucking great album. Deal with it.
Yeah, you do. I'll say this, the most unsurprising thing about the Talking Heads is that they're art school kids.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's the least surprising thing you'll ever find out about them. You're like, oh yeah, 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 of course. Yeah. What other thing would they be pursuing?
Yeah. So, it also pretty makes sense to mention that Chris France on the drums, Tina Weymouth on the bass, they've actually been a couple since the 70s. They're still together today.
Nice.
They're married in 1977.
Nice.
Which is the year their first album came out, Talking Heads 77, if you're wondering.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, art school kids in a time of punk, like, all in on the punk. They were obviously playing a lot of the same venues. They played CBGBs a hell of a lot. But obviously, their music, whilst definitely having some sort of influence, moved further. As punk, basically, in the mainstream sense that people know, has sort of died off.
Yeah.
They started working with Brian Eno.
Nice.
They did a lot of work with Brian Eno. The next Class. Four albums, I believe, all had Brian Eno involvement.
I've been very aware of Brian Eno since my childhood, so that's fun to know. It is interesting, like, you see the a similar kind of thing with Blondie, in that they also started out in that same scene, but then were very much kind of outgrew it, I suppose, and became much more influential, I think, probably because of it.
Because I know he did a lot with Devo at this time.
Mm.
David Byrne and Mark Mothersbaugh. Jesus Christ, working with David Byrne and Mark Mothersbaugh.
Special kind of man.
Yeah, that is an intriguing combination of people to work with. I mean, yeah. Like, because you'd get a lot of, shall we say, creative input from those two people.
Yes.
But yeah, so the album's more songs about buildings and food, comes out in 1978. That's the first time they worked with Brian Eno. After that, you have Fear of Music, 1979, which is a fucking great record. After that, you then get Remain in Light, which is a fucking incredible record. And then about three or so years later, you get Speaking in Tongues, which also includes the song Burning Down the House, which is probably their biggest actual hit single.
Okay.
They weren't really a big super mega hit singles band.
That doesn't surprise me, but yeah.
Like, if anything, bizarrely, Burning Down the House was actually a big hit for somebody else as well. I will go try. All right, here's a fun little game.
Oh, no, don't make me guess, people.
No, I'm going to make you fucking guess, because okay. This is hilarious. So Burning Down the House actually was a hit in the 90s on the UK charts. Not the American charts, the UK charts. Top 10.
Ooh, okay, so...
1999.
Let's 20 questions our way to this. It's either going to be a dance hit or a boy band hit, right? One
You're
of the two?
You're
going to
lose your fucking mind when I
But
tell
am
you
I am I on the right track? I'm just feeling very 90s.
No.
Oh, not at all. Neither of those things.
No,
okay.
It's just, I think this is so ridiculous. I love it. I didn't even realise this until about 30 minutes ago.
Is it like Mr. Blobby or some shit?
No.
Am I getting closer?
Absolutely nowhere near.
Okay. I'm trying to think what's in the 90s. And my three things would be dance music, boy and girl bands, and Mr. Blobby. I don't know what else.
You're so far away.
Or grunge. But like, that's too late for grunge in 99. And also in the UK... Oasis. I don't know.
I'll tell you.
Tell me.
All right, you never got it, but you'll kick yourself. It's two artists. One's a solo artist, Tom Jones, and the Cardigans.
What? I wouldn't have gotten that. That doesn't make any sense.
I didn't even know this until until I was just looking over my notes for the last time.
90s Tom Jones is a wild ride.
Yeah.
Love that. Love that for him. I only know the Cardigans for that one song.
Yeah.
They're kind of a one-hit wonder.
Loveful.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Am I forgetting something else?
Are you forgetting my favourite game?
Oh, that's true.
Get
two hits.
Get out.
I forgot that was the Cardigans. I didn't forget the song.
Technically, three hits. Burning Down the House cover.
That's true.
It's three hits.
Well, there
it's
we are.
More hits than I've ever had.
That's true.
I've had zero hits. I can't complain.
My favourite game is a bop, I gotta say. I'm gonna add that to a playlist later.
All right. So, briefly, I just want to talk about the concept of the concert film.
Hmm.
At this time, the concert film, there have been a few. There haven't been like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, but... It was seen as, I wouldn't say it was seen as like a indulgence, but it wasn't exactly seen as like a major big sort of, this could actually be a really successful commercial stream.
Yeah, it's not the big money maker.
No, like the most famous example probably before this was The Last Waltz, which was directed by some fella called Martin Scorsese. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's, I think he's done something.
Scorsese?
Scorsese's. Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of him, but... You know, apparently he's a nice fella. He's done some films that some people have watched.
What band is that?
The Band.
Oh, okay.
The proper 60s stuff.
Okay, but it's not weird that I haven't heard of that.
No.
Okay.
Like, you might have heard of the film The Last Waltz,
but I haven't heard of the band. No.
Yeah. Another sort of big example you could probably use is Pink Floyd Live at Pompeii.
Yeah.
But the concert film, and obviously there was like various Beatles footage and what have you, but it wasn't necessarily the biggest or even a medium that many people were super bothered by. Like, it would become much more of a thing going through the 80s, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say that they all decided they wanted to stop making sense, but a part of me kind of thinks
it's interesting, and I'm not gonna step on what I assume you're gonna talk about, but I've seen a lot of over the years, do you know, in the peak time of like from VHS to DVD, where you just owned a lot of physical media, we had a lot of different kind of like concert films, essentially. Yeah. Like, I had more than one Queen concert film I'd ever met. Like, a lot of like essentially recorded concerts.
Yeah.
But this feels very different.
Yes.
Like in how it's, in everything about it, actually.
Yep.
Whereas a lot of concert films feel like they got a nice camera set up
yeah.
and good sound set up and then just filmed what would be every live show they did. Whereas this doesn't necessarily... I don't think the Talking Heads did every live show like this, I assume. Maybe they did. But it feels like they kind of staged it in a particular way.
This tour was basically staged this way.
Okay.
They have there's other footage from other times, like they, you know, they performed on various TV shows.
Yeah.
It's very weird when you watch them, like the old Grey Whistle Test doing Psycho Killer, because like David Byrne's wearing a yellow polo shirt, which is very bizarre. Like it looks both right and wrong.
I mean, for a song called Psycho Killer, it does work. I want to watch that now, but you know what I mean. Like, I think my sense is that most bands don't they'll put a lot of work into like the playing and the set list, but the way that this is sort of staged out, I suppose, feels much more involved than the usual concert film.
Yes,
I suppose what I'm getting at.
Yeah. So for context of how revered this film is. This film has actually been preserved by the National Film Registry at the Library of Congress in the year 2021.
Hmm.
Would you like to know the other films that were selected for the 2021 list for preservation?
Do tell.
Just for context.
Do tell.
WALL-E.
Yeah.
Nightmare on Elm Street, the original one. Return of the Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
Fellowship of the Ring. Stop Making Sense.
Some big names.
Yeah.
Big swings there.
Yeah. So... Chris Rance, he mentioned in his autobiography Remain in Love about the production of this film. It was a no-brainer that the Speaking in Tongues tour should be captured on film. As the tour progressed, the band and production got tighter and tighter. Nobody had a rock show this hot. One day, we were approached by a young filmmaker named Jonathan Demme and his fellow filmmaker girlfriend, Sandy McLeod. They wanted to make a film of the show. So they were approached.
Mm.
It wasn't necessarily... like, they knew they wanted to do it, but they weren't necessarily like, you know... they weren't going to the big director. They weren't saying to Steven Spielberg, like, oi, come and film our show. Like, they wanted someone, I think, that sort of was on, I don't want to say, on the same wavelength. That sounds so fucking trite.
No, but there is something about when you're doing something creatively with someone that you're kind of on the same page about what you're trying to get at.
Yeah.
Or else you will just scrap, I think.
Yeah. You could easily, like, with hindsight, you can easily make the argument that this footage is literally... a band at the peak of their powers. This is not this was not designed as this is our last shot, or we're about to break up, or you know, we're all hating each other.
This wasn't the farewell tour.
No. But in all actuality, this is the last tour. Like, they never toured after this cycle. They never toured again.
But that wasn't necessarily the plan while they were doing this.
No.
Yeah. So.
Absolutely not. The interpersonal politics is something that, in order for me to sort of accurately describe it, I would need to basically read about 15 books. And also, I can really sum up quite simply, there is conflict.
Yeah.
There's no other way to say it.
At a certain point, that's why a lot of bands break up, isn't it? Yeah. People just don't get on anymore in this very intense workplace, essentially, that they are in. Yeah.
It's really, I might mention a little bit more about it later, but like, to fully accurately describe who said what and what did, I don't feel comfortable definitively saying this happened or that happened, because it feels very much like two sets of people across purposes.
Yeah.
But yeah. So you were mentioning how the thing was conceived. So when you watch the film, you see a credit very early on, in the credits. That didn't make sense, did it? There's so many ways I can throw in the words, this didn't make sense, or we need to stop making sense. The credit says, conceived for the stage by David Byrne. Not directed, not starring.
I do love that credit.
For the stage.
I do love that. That is excellent.
Not by Talking Heads, David Byrne.
That also kind of makes sense that it was, by someone at least, conceived for the stage. Because like I say, it's not just everyone comes out, curtain goes up, and they play the songs.
Yeah.
There is an element of... this was kind of thought out and choreographed to a certain degree.
He explicitly said this. I heard him say it in an interview with himself.
Yes.
one of the weirdest videos I've ever seen, but it also makes certain things make a lot of sense. If you'd pardon the pun. See, it's ridiculous. Right, so the film begins with David Byrne just walking out with a ghetto blaster and an acoustic guitar. He puts it down, he says he wants to play a song, and he plays this version of Psycho Killer, which is basically him, acoustic guitar, and like a loop, like loop drums.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting choice, because Psycho Killer was a very, very popular song,
mm.
partly because of its bass line,
Yeah.
Which is non-existent.
The baseline is...
the thing most people know about that song.
The song, yeah.
Yeah. Boom, boom, boom. Yeah.
I think it's still probably my favourite Talking Heads song. It's the first song I really... obsessed over by them.
Yeah.
And it still remains, I think, one of my favourite songs by them. I like this version of it.
What's interesting for me with the Talking Heads is, right, like, I knew that song when I was little, but I knew, like, Talking Heads has sort of been on the periphery of my life pretty much since I was old enough to understand what music was.
Hmm.
Partly because I thought the lyric was weird in the chorus, and it sounded like, when you're a little child, like, things that sound a bit odd make sense.
Oh, the French in it, like...
The far, far, far...
Oh, yeah. Far, far, far,
yeah. Yeah, like, I never heard the actual full song. I knew the chorus since I was very small, but I never thought, oh, I need to listen to more of that when I got a little bit old. In fact, I didn't properly actually listen to Talking Heads until, like, lockdown.
Oh, nice. I didn't...
properly listen.
I first heard this song at an open mic when I was 20 years old.
Yeah.
By someone doing the cover of it.
Yeah.
And then I went and listened to the actual song.
Yeah.
And so that's how, but I knew who the Talking Heads were because of like Once in a Lifetime and all those kind of more songs that have videos and things and that show up in compilations,
it's strange,
that kind of thing.
Yeah, because I sort of heard Once in a Lifetime as well, but I never put the two and two together, and I never was like, I never truly appreciated that song again, truly appreciated it until like 2020.
Oh, same. I thought it was... I kind of thought it was a bit of a silly, dumb song until maybe the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Because the video was silly and out of context when you're like... especially when you're a teenager and it's on like, you know, VH1 or some shit.
Yeah.
You're like, this is dumb. Whereas now, I'm like, oh, no, I get it now. But it takes much more context for my brain to be like, yeah, no, that isn't just like a silly single that was big.
Yeah.
There we are.
Yeah. So when he's playing Psycho Killer, like, he's doing a lot of foot stamping.
Yes.
Like, the camera, unlike most concert films, the band is basically, like, you don't see the audience until quite literally the last song. And even then, you see maybe like three people. This film is a film of the concert. This is not, you know, we're going to have a concert and then we're going to cut some random audience going, oh my God.
Yeah.
Which, with hindsight, I honestly, if I ever see another new concert film, if I see them cut to the audience, it will just annoy me because I'm like, why, with respect to the audience members.
I don't care.
I don't give a fuck.
Even, I've seen, especially at like much bigger shows, like arena and stadium shows, where they like zoom out and they're like, look how big the audience is. Yeah. I'm like, I truly do not care.
And also, we know.
I do not care.
Like, you know the audience is big because it's in a stadium.
If it's in Wembley, it's a big audience.
If you're like, oh, live from something stadium, it's like, well, it's obviously going to be big then.
Yeah.
Like, you can do a big drone shot at the start, but like, I really don't need to see it during the guitar solo to your most famous song.
There's a tightness to the, you know, like, it is kind of like tight in on the stage.
Yeah.
It does shots of each individual, but it doesn't zoom out necessarily, like you say, and go into the audience.
Yeah.
That does, there is a power to that.
Yeah. I don't want to say, oh, it's so punk, because that sounds, again, so fucking trite, and it sounds...
But that is kind of their vibe. I mean, they're trying things. They're going off in a bit of a weird direction and doing stuff people aren't necessarily doing.
Mm.
Like, even if it isn't punk in its sound necessarily, it is kind of punk in its sensibility.
Yeah. Mm. Yes, so after Psycho Killer, they move into a song called Heaven, which this version of it, like... This is one of those things, you know, when people say, oh, it's the live album's better than the studio material. Most of the time, I'm like, no, they're just different.
Yeah.
This is the one exception. Like, basically every song, especially from the really early records, from like the first
from
one,
the 70s.
More songs about buildings and food and Fear of Music, they all sound like bigger. They sound bigger, they sound better. It sounds like they were supposed to sound like Heaven, which you know, Teen Wayne was just like sort of off in the corner, so you now have a second person on stage, but you also have one of the backing singers who is providing these absolutely gorgeous fucking harmonies. Oh my God, that fucking chorus. Heaven, this must be the place where there is nothing. Like, the harmony on that is fucking ridiculous.
Mm.
Like, it's as good as anything you can ever hear when you ever hear a good, like, an amazing harmony vocal. Like, it is that good. Like, David Byrne's voice is a little bit strange. Like, he himself would not call it. Like, no one would sit there and say, oh, David Byrne's got a beautiful baritone. Like, that's not the vibe.
No.
That's not the vibe.
He's a unique
at all.
Vocalist.
Yeah. It's very, yeah.
Like, you know it's him.
Yeah.
Which is actually probably a good thing.
Yeah. He actually talks about this a bit later, but we'll get to that a little bit later. So basically, each of the first few songs, like, more and more people appear on stage. Like, so you basically don't get the full actual Talking Heads, because Talking Heads is a four piece. And you don't get the full version of all, you don't get all four of them on stage until, like, track four?
Yeah, it's one person per track, kind of.
Yeah. They play a version of the song Found a Job, and that's the first time you see all four members of Talking Heads on stage together. But it's also the last time you see just the four members of Talking Heads, because this concert, they are accompanied by not one, but five other musicians.
Talking Heads plus friends.
And, like, I put it this way. If you're going to bring in five other people, if you're going to bring in five other people, the five people they bring in, Lynn Mabry and Edna Holt on backing vocals, Bernie Worrell on keyboard, Steve Scales on percussion and other backing vocals, and Alex Weir on guitar and backing vocals, all five of these people are essentially the best musicians you've never heard.
Yeah, they're all top of their game. Like, they're
unbelievable.
I'll say this, they're really adding something to the songs. And it's interesting to see people kind of swap around and stuff at different points as well. But, like, I never felt throughout it, what's this guy doing here? Yeah. You know what I mean? Because, like, I think sometimes you can see, like, very big backing bands and be like, what are they doing?
Yeah.
How many keyboardists do you need?
Yeah. So David Byrne said something about how, like, the show needs to go somewhere. He said, our hope was that through the way it was filmed, you do get to know the personalities of the band members and the various people who play on stages that introduced, and that Jonathan would cut to them when they're doing something that reveals their personality rather than when they're doing something flashy like a solo. You think of those people rather than as something else.
That's interesting. But yes, I do get that.
Mm.
I do think it kind of... Like, I did kind of come away with a like... feeling like a vibe for each particular person on stage, you know, whether it was a member of the band proper or whether it was one of the backing singers or one of the, you know, backing musicians or something. They all had their own kind of thing.
Yes. Like, I also, with the way they were all dressed, because they obviously, it is shot over three different nights. They weren't necessarily like, there wasn't like an official dress code, but David Byrne had very explicitly said to everybody, like, wear something that's not, like, super distinctive, as it were. So basically, don't walk out in, like, a jazzy fucking, like, multicoloured suit or whatever. Speaking of suits, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. That'll make
no
sense.
No one else gets to wear a jazzy suit.
But it's really funny because Chris France is just like, I'm just going to wear a turquoise shirt. Like, everyone else is wearing sort of muted grey. Very muted greyish
neutral, you know.
very neutral. He's like, nope, gonna wear a turquoise polo shirt, get fucked.
he was given the most kind of like dad energy, like very intense, like very excellent drummer, but like as if, like, you know, a dad kind of popped up and was like, yeah, I'm wearing my shirt, you know. Because he did kind of look different.
Yeah.
He was given different energy to the rest of the band.
He was great. Yeah, he was throwing out some ad libs, as it were. But I just want to say, the version of Burning Down the House on this movie, slash, you can get this as a live record, you can get it as a record as well. The actual original live release, which only doesn't even have like half the songs on it, the original one. It was the one. It was a massive hit in the charts.
Yeah,
it was in the top. It was in Billboard for like 200 weeks or something ridiculous. Wow. And that doesn't even have half the fucking songs in it. The original one. It's got like eight of the songs. Which I'm like, what? And this is one of those things where there's like different versions of, you know, there's a version that, like, the original home release version has 19 songs. I think three of the songs had some sort of... I don't know why the other three songs haven't been... I don't know. There's some sort of technical thing. I've never been able to work it out. But, like, the DVD and the Blu-ray versions cut three of the songs out, and I think it's something to do with the way they were filmed.
Okay.
I've tried to understand why that was the case. I don't think I could fully get it. So I thought I would leave that out, as it were. But yeah, the version of Burn Down the House on this is like fucking euphoric.
Mm.
This isn't a video, this isn't a show where there's like fireworks and tons of projections. There's one moment where there's like projections on some sort of back screen.
Yes.
But that's like... it, and it's just words.
Yeah.
It's random words. Like, and then there's a lampshade which gets used a bit later, which I'll talk about.
Mm.
And then there's some sort of, I don't know, big suit. Which it,
like, it's very physical. I'll say that. It's very physical on stage.
Yeah.
There isn't any pyro, there isn't any backing. Like, it is there with them in their bodies, essentially, if they're going to use something, which is interesting. Because, again, having seen a lot of live shows, just going to gigs and stuff, like your projections and your pyro or smoke or whatever, they are usually, not always, but for many bands, they are usually the thing.
Yeah.
That if you're going to add to the stage show. Whereas I do find some of the more engaging live shows I've been to have been that more physical, like I'm literally holding this thing in my hands kind of stuff. So yeah, it was interesting to see this also in like a filmed environment.
Yeah. I don't know what beans David Byrne was eating before doing these shows, but he's basically
much energy.
It's unbelievable.
It's like shocking him. Yeah. Like, in fairness, they're all going for it.
Yeah.
But he's just so never needs to take a breath almost. It feels like.
There's so much like random foot stomping. Like, I'll talk about some of the other stuff a bit later, but like the way everybody is just grooving around the room to the form of like it's not like, you know, incredibly amazing choreographed dancing. These are like all the actual steps that people are sort of doing are things that you could do.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Like, there's a bit where Jerry Harrison and Lynn and Edna, the two backing singers, are like doing a little synchronized jump together.
Yeah.
And it's adorable. But like, provided you are able to jump, you can do it. Like,
yeah. It's kind of stuff you could do to your friends at like a night out or a wedding or, you know, you're feeling a bit silly and fun.
Yeah. It's not, you know, we spent two
professional
months...
Professional dancers.
Yeah, we spent 2 months doing stuff. Choreography for this. Even though it was conceived for the stage.
Yeah.
It's not a stage play.
No.
So Psycho Killer is insane.
Yes.
Not Psycho... Burn Down the House, sorry. Burn Down the House is like...
Yeah.
If this band showed up at your wedding and they played that, even if you've never heard the song...
Oh, yeah, you have a good
You
time.
Are fucking dancing.
Yeah, yeah.
I would not be surprised if all the people in the audience were just up off their seats, just fucking going absolutely bananas. Because I want to every time I fucking think about that version. It's so euphoric and joyous.
Mm.
It impresses me much more than if they just stood there and then, like, at the end of the song, they hit a snare drum and there's like a firework. Like, that would leave me completely like, oh, wow, you did a firework. Well done. Because that to me is not... Like, I have a little... This is, as this is somewhat related, I am going to use my platform to briefly talk about stagecraft, because this is, you know, it's relevant, I get to do it. Like, I see a lot of bands, they do a lot of, like, things where, you know, they'll stand and play a song, but at the end of the song, ooh, some pyro will go off, hooray, wow, impressive, and the audience always like, ooh, the band aren't setting off the pyro. They're not setting up the pyro and setting it off. They're not trained pyrotechnicians.
Mm.
They think it's there because it looks good. And does it look good? Yeah, once or twice. But
I think it's contextual.
It's contextual, but also...
on how effective it is.
I find myself rolling my eyes at it now because it's such a fucking cop-out, in my opinion. It's so fucking easy.
Mm.
It's so easy to say, oh, we're going to have pyro in this song. Like, yeah, you... aren't doing anything with it apart from, oh, look, some fire goes up.
Yeah.
Because, like, I don't know, you said something about, oh, now the fire's going to burn inside. Ooh, like, ooh, good for you. But I find it, in the most cases, incredibly uninteresting. And to me, it just masks a complete lack of any sort of nous or anything interesting that you want to say. It also takes away, for me, it takes away the message of the music for a lot of these bands that do it. Because, like, my favourite ones... I'm not gonna name it. I don't want to be a shithead and slag people.
Don't be slagging
for this, because it's not necessarily a slag. It's more of a preference.
Mm.
Like when bands use like CO2 canisters, and it drowns out the music, and they use it off like a massive drop of like either a huge riff or like a big chorus or whatever, and you can't actually hear it because all you can hear is the hiss of the CO2. Yes,
that is annoying.
And you just go, not only does that look stupid, I now can't hear you. So if you were trying to say something with it, you've quite literally cancelled yourself. You have done the thing that all these people that moan about, oh, I got cancelled because someone didn't like my tweet. No. But I'm on my mainstream newspaper column to talk about. You've actually cancelled yourself.
Yeah. What you've actually cancelled is this sweet riff dropping.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, again, not like there are like two examples I have in particular. I'm not going to name because it just seems really
you
petty.
You can tell me when we turn off the mic.
Oh, you already know.
Oh, secret like, for me. I have suspicions.
But, yeah, like, you watch Stop Making Sense and you're just like,
yeah.
I'll probably talk about it further later, but like, you hear them do Burning Down the House. You hear the, like, the percussion. You hear the, like, to my knowledge, the reason it's called Burning Down the House is because, like, it's something that people used to chant at, like, Parliament Funkadelic shows that they would occasionally go to.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember if Chris France said that or something. But, you know, it's not actually about, like, going up to someone's house and being like, oh, I'm going to burn it down.
No, no.
It's not pro-arson. Thank you.
Thank you for clearing that up. Yeah. For many years, David people Byrne, have assumed not pro-arson. That they literally took that title as what it was about.
Yeah. But what I am overall trying to say is, dancing around, just going for it and having fun, to me, it sticks in my brain a lot more than pyro. Just random shots of pyro.
Because
it's always random. It's never, like, in service of something else. It's always just random shots of pyro by people that have absolutely fuck all else to say or do, so they have to put that in there because they can't think of anything else. They think, when they think big show, it literally just means pyro or an occasionally some lights. They don't do anything creative with those lights or interesting, because I know bands that do amazing things with lights more than pyro.
I've seen some really interesting things with lights, light and shadow kind of stuff.
Like even band that I talked about previously on this podcast, Amon Amarth, they lose a lot of pyro and shit. But they also do shit like have random dudes fighting each other dressed as Vikings, which is more interesting. As silly as that may look to some folks, that is more memorable than interesting, because these are songs about, you know, Vikings. So they are actually literally putting, like, people on stage to show that. Like, that is more interesting to me than, you know, oh, this song's about depression and then there's, like, a bit of fire halfway through. Just like, yeah, or, good for you.
Like, when I, to reference one of the things I've covered on this podcast, like, seeing Lingua Ignota live, she has a lot of stuff with just, like, screens and, like, light bars.
Yeah.
And she carries the light bars around with her. And, you know, I saw her in a small venue and it's just light and dark.
Yeah.
And how she's moving stuff around or interacting with those screens.
Yeah.
And it's really affecting. And it's very minimal, really, you know, but it serves the songs, like, it matches the tone of those songs. So there's like a lot of kind of creative stagecraft going on out there.
Like, I mean, so Burning Down the House is energetic as hell, and then after that, literally straight after that, they go into Life During Wartime, which the performance of is essentially an aerobics fucking workout.
Yes, that's not what they're running.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like,
just running on the spot.
There's
for
like
most
five
of
people
it.
Just running on the spot.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Tina Weymouth is playing bass. Oh my god, it's just
jogging on the spot.
And David Byrne's doing some weird, like, thing with his knees. Oh, it's just so much fun.
Yes.
It's so,
They all seem like they're having good crack, I will say, like, on stage. And there is something about, in any medium, because I say this a lot about, like, certain movies and stuff as well. Like, you're like, well, they're having fun with it.
Yeah.
They're clearly having a great time for themselves.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it's a slog or anything like that. And they seem to be having a good time.
Yeah.
But that emits out to the audience, I think, or the viewer.
Yeah. You're
like, okay, I'm going to have a good time with this too, you know?
Yeah. There's a point later in the show, like, oh my god, like, David Byrne's sort of stage presence, especially during Life During Wartime, other people of the time, you know, other sort of big rock stars, as it were, you know, David Byrne, you can't really call him a sexy rock star. Like, you don't listen to Talking Heads because, like, oh, sex, drugs, rock and roll, ooh.
Yeah,
none of
that's not the vibe.
That is not the vibe. That is completely, despite the fact that there is a very beautiful woman on stage in the fucking band.
Yeah.
This is not a, like, ooh, you know, you don't sit there and go, ooh, take it away with me.
No, this is
not at all.
They still come across as art school kids,
yeah,
I think.
They really
That's
do.
The vibe.
Yeah.
Like, art school is the energy I'm getting from it, you know?
Yeah. David Byrne's dropping some sweet moves with his knees.
Yeah.
I find that, again, so much more fucking engaging.
It's very compelling. Yes. It's very compelling as a front man. Like, you do want to watch him and be like, what's coming next?
Yeah.
What moves are coming next? I've been walking around this house since we watched you doing that little stomp.
Yeah.
It's fun. Just doing a little stomp. Being like, Louis, look at me. Look at me do this stomp. It's great. Doing some great moves.
Yeah.
Catch me at whatever the next wedding I go to is.
Yeah.
I'll be pulling out those moves.
Yeah. You'll notice that at no point during the show does he ever, like, stop for, like, 5 minutes to say, like, how you're feeling tonight.
No, I don't think...
He doesn't do that.
I don't think he talks to the audience except at the very start to say, like, this is the song I'm going to play or whatever. They don't really stop and talk to the audience at all.
The only person who seems to talk to the audience is Chris France during the bit where David Byrne goes off stage when they do Genius of Love by the Tom Tom Club.
Yeah.
That's basically the only time there's any sort of actual, like, chat.
Mm.
And it's not even like, how you feeling tonight? Or like, you're the best crowd ever. You're the best crowd on this tour. Which are two things that I am increasingly fucking annoyed. If I hear someone say, you're the best crowd on this tour, if I don't see definitive fucking evidence about how you've come to that conclusion, the data, then I want that bit to
you
fuck off.
You
want to
see the graph?
Because it's so disingenuous.
Yeah.
There's no need for it.
It reminds me of...
It really makes me go, fuck off.
You know the Spinal Tap bit in The Simpsons where he pulls, open the guitar and goes, Springfield!
Yeah. Good night, Springton. There will be no encores. Medium setting.
So bury that. And they talk at the end to, like, name the people in the band.
Yeah.
But... Which I actually like that when bands do that.
Especially if you're playing with five other people.
Yes. But they're not a band that necessarily talks very much to the... Or in this tour anyway, that is talking to the crowd. They are performing the show.
Yeah. I just get real bee in my bonnet with, like, fake disingenuous crowd shit.
Because
there's just no need for it. No one actually... Does anyone actually sit and go, oh, they better fucking say we're a good crowd. They better fucking say we're the best crowd.
I'm waiting for...
Does anyone actually believe that?
I'm waiting for you to, like... In my mind, like, you turn 40, right? And you're like, now is the time, actually, I'm going to start a hardcore band. And your whole bit is pitting cities against each other. You're shit, London. Manchester were great. Fuck you. That's you.
But people do that anyway. They do that. They go, oh, man, we were in Manchester last night. They were better than here. And everyone goes, boo.
Oh, no, I don't mean it in that way. I mean literally just being like, straight up, here's the data. You have the charts.
Well, that's the logical bit.
You bring the... That's your screen behind you.
That's the logical
bit.
You bring
the charts.
And even if it's fake data, that's funny.
Yeah.
Like, that... You know, I like frontmen who are funny. Like,
and then
a lot of my favourite frontmen are just naturally funny people. Like...
They have a natural charm. Or
yeah, they're not sitting there going, oh, you're the best crowd. They'll just like say, oh man, I got stuck in the airport line and that shit's funny.
Mm.
You know, or, oh, I got stuck, you know, I had to tie my shoe. Like, just anything that is amusing and just normal. Like, I don't need to be told that I'm the best fucking audience because I have no way of believing that because you have no way of measuring it. You could do it. Like, you could have a decibel meter and then, like, literally as a bit, make the crowd do, like, a big fucking... chant, and then you can, like, record it. You could actually make it a thing for social media content. In fact, I'm stunned straight up that no one has actually tried this yet, because there are so many young bands who are all basically TikTok creators as well as musicians. I'm stunned that no one has actually done that yet. It has to have happened. It probably has happened, I don't know, but it's exactly the sort of thing that would do really well on TikTok. Like, it would.
Hire Louis to be your TikTok producer.
I'm not a TikTok
producer.
No. Hire someone much younger than me to do that. But that is an idea I would
hire
steal
someone
it.
15 years younger than us to be your TikTok producer.
Steal it, 100%. Because it would make... Honestly, it would do so much... Yeah, because I... Yeah. But as a whole, I just hate disingenuous bullshit.
Yeah.
From frontmen. I don't give a fuck how good you are. So you stop being disingenuous. I'm like... I'm not saying you've lost me, but it does. It genuinely makes me enjoy the show less. Cause I'm just like, you didn't really need to say that. I don't believe you. Like, you're trying to sell. Like, you're trying to sell. This is your authentic presentation of yourself, and you're putting yourself into your art. But then you come out with disingenuous bullshit. Then why should I believe your art? Cause that's how I see it. Other people may not look at it in that way, and that's absolutely fine. But that is how I see it. Like, that's why it annoys me so much. Sorry, that sounded a bit ranty, didn't it?
Yeah, this is your fuck frontman rant.
No! Being a good frontman is incredible art.
Yes, really, no, I agree. Yeah.
You know, and but my point is, you don't need to do disingenuous shit if that's not you.
Yeah.
David Byrne is not that person.
No.
Like, watch any interviews of that man. That bloke is not a how you all doing tonight front man. He can't be.
No.
You watch a single interview with him from any point in his life, that is just not him.
Yeah.
It just isn't him at all. Like, yeah. I really want to shout out in particular the performance of This Must Be the Place, Brackets Naive Melody.
Mm.
To give it its full title. Because that is, there's a bit more stagecraft there. That is basically, This Must Be the Place is as close to a love song as you get.
Yeah.
Like, so he said about the song, that's a love song made up almost completely of non sequiturs, phrases that may have a strong emotional resonance but don't have any narrative qualities. It's a real honest kind of love song. I don't think I've ever done a real love song before. Mine always had a sort of reservation or a twist. I tried to write one that wasn't corny, that didn't sound stupid or lame the way many do. I think I succeeded. I was pretty happy with that. So, for context, he basically sings this song, like, so it's him, Lynn and Edna, Tina Wemf to his left. They're all holding, like, wired mics. They're all holding, you know, usually the mics have been on the stand, but this song, they're not. He basically sings it under a lampshade.
Mm.
And then he, like, sort of holds the lampshade all lovingly and shit, and he, like, throws it yeah. across and runs and catches it, throws it around and catches it. Like, it's very odd, but it's so weirdly entertaining.
Yeah.
Like, he basically does a dance with a lampshade.
Yeah.
Which is 1,000 times more memorable than a random pyro hit. Like, you know, I just have this random image of him just, like, the lampshade, like, going across and him running in this weird way to, like, catch it and doing it again.
Yeah.
Like, because he's not running like a normal, like, I think it is, dare I say, choreographed movement.
It's a planned kind of running. Yeah, it's a planned run. Like, not mime is the wrong word, but you know when you ask to mime a movement, you do it in slow motion, you often do it bigger.
Yeah.
It's kind of that. Yeah, it's
very
stylized.
Very theatre. Yes. Very theatre.
Look, we've all been asked to use the space. Yeah. You and I have both been in that situation in acting classes.
We've used the space.
Use the space. Do a freeze.
Yeah.
We're going to explore the space in slow motion. And you do big old movements.
Yeah. And then, like, so that's gorgeous. Then straight after that, you get Once in a Lifetime.
He gets the glasses out. You got to.
He gets the glasses out. He, like, starts, like, every time, and during the course, he just starts slapping himself.
Yeah.
Like, he just starts, like, donking himself on the forehead.
Yeah.
Like, not aggressively, but it's just...
But not unaggressively, either.
Yeah. Same as it ever was, bang. Bang. Same as it ever was, bang. Like, I can't explain it. Like, there must be... there is obviously a logic to it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's ever been explicit about this was the reason I chose this particular movement for this song during this cycle. Because as a solo artist in the last 30 years, he does perform many Talking Head songs during those shows. I haven't seen David Byrne's American Utopia yet. I intend to see it pretty fucking soon.
Mm.
It's on my list of things to watch. I have it saved, ready to go. I know that that is in the set list for David Byrne's American Utopia because I've heard it, sort of how it's performed, because I know he did it on Saturday Night Live, and it's very different. It's not the same.
Yeah.
That's a whole different concept. I don't be surprised if we're still doing the show in a few years. Don't be surprised if I do that on this podcast. Mm. Don't be surprised. But the performance of that song is incredible. Great harmonies again. The weird slapping of himself.
Yeah. I kind of get it. Like, in terms of, like, same as ever was, you're banging your head against a wall kind of thing. You know, I get it. And there is something like, this is what I get out of watching dance and stuff. Sometimes you don't need to explain it, but you do feel something.
Yeah.
About, like, it still makes you, kind of pushes you towards particular emotions and things in the way that, like, using different vocalizations will push you towards different emotions of things. It's sometimes I'm sometimes interested in teasing those things apart, but often just more thinking about, like, well, what's the effect of them? And I think it works in that context.
Yeah. I've been sort of saving a lot of chat about certain parts of the show for this little bit. Now, yes, we will get to the big suit shortly.
Big suit.
But first, I'd like to dedicate the next few minutes to Tina Weymouth, the other star of this show.
Yes. Killing it on bass.
I
such a tight bass player.
There is someone who literally clipped this whole show, so it's just all the bits of Tina Weymouth in it.
Perfect.
What an absolute maniac.
What a great supercut.
27 minutes and 36 seconds.
That's pretty good.
That's every time she's on screen, not when she can be heard. So that is, I mean, that's a lot of effort. The amount of time, like, honestly, you didn't need to go to that level.
Look, people do things on the internet, Louis. You just gotta accept it's just a weird one. It's like, gonna happen.
So, after Once in a Lifetime, David Byrne goes on stage. So, between about 1918 and 1983, so between the Remain Light tour and the recording and release of Speaking in Tongues, Chris France, Tina Weymouth, they do a side project. David Byrne also did a solo record. I think Jerry Harrison did one as well. They did a record and they called themselves the Tom Tom Club. So it's like, it's hard to, they're sort of like funk influenced, really heavily funk influenced. And they released a big song from that record, which has been sampled a billion times.
Yeah.
Is the song Genius of Love. And they perform it during the show while David Byrne goes and...
he's getting big suit ready.
He starts getting big suit ready.
Yeah.
And part of, well, during this performance as well, like, again, this is where Chris France basically sort of takes over as the front man, as it were, even though he's not actually the lead singer. There's a moment, like, the bass line of Genius of Love is fucking great. Like, Genius of Love is a delightful song. Like, it has been sampled multiple times, as I say.
Do you have a favourite sample?
I don't really know if
I
have a favourite sample.
Why would I listen to the sampled songs when I can listen to the original? Is that your take? Is that the take of Louis Tanguini?
I mean, I know it's been fancy. I know it's been sampled by, I think it's been sampled by Mariah Carey. I might be wrong. I am right. I'm absolutely fucking right. Fantasy by Mariah Carey. I think it was sampled quite recently. Like, it's one of those songs. It's got sampled by someone who clearly made like a TikTok song with it.
Sure.
Yeah, it's one of those. I know 50 Cent's done it. I know that. I want to say Busta Rhymes has done it at some point. I think Ice Cube has done it. Like, it's been used a lot.
Yeah.
I know I'm missing off a lot of people.
It's an artist fave sample.
Yeah. I'm absolutely missing off a lot of folks.
That's quite a lot, though. Like, there's not a lot of songs that get sampled to. There are some, but, like, there are not huge amounts of songs that are so frequently sampled by different artists.
Apparently Paramore used a sample of it live a few years ago.
Okay.
To, like, lead into another song, which is pretty sweet. But, yeah, like, Tina Weymouth's bass playing.
She's so
self-taught, by the way.
Yes! Mate!
I'm pretty certain.
I love that!
I think I might be wrong, or I might be... I don't know. I'm 99% certain.
You're hotly speculating.
She basically was asked to do it. I've heard her say that David Byrne was, like, absolutely not to her joining the band as a bass player, like, multiple times. But even during the band, because she basically had to teach herself because they didn't have a bass player.
Look, there's many a bass player who became a bass player because they're like, oh, we don't have a bassist in this band. And I was like, I'll fucking do it. Like, I part of me learning the bass when I was like 12 or 13 was trying to start a band with my other 12 and 13 friends being like, I'll fucking learn the bass.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how I learned the bass. You know? And I learned from a guy in school.
Yeah.
And also the internet.
Yeah. Like, you know, there's so many moments during this where you're just looking, just like, whether she's playing bass or like weird keyboards or whatever, or playing guitar, you just go, this is the coolest person on stage.
Yes.
But there are also moments where Steve Scales is the coolest person on stage, Alex Weir is the coolest person on stage.
There is a lot of like multi-instrumentalist folk on stage. Like,
basically
everyone kind of does most things. The only person who's like not really moving is France, but that makes sense because he's on the drums.
Yeah.
Which is fair enough.
Yeah.
But everyone else is kind of chopping and changing a little bit as the song begs, I suppose, or as like the song requires, and that's cool.
Yeah, it's
pretty cool.
Yeah, but like, oh fuck! Like, I don't know how you can move on the spot in that way and play bass during life during wartime. I don't know how you do that.
It's very
impressive. It's not a straight dum 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 bass line.
Very few of the bass lines are.
It's really simple. They're not super complex. They're not like intricate, horrifyingly impossible things to work out.
But they're playable. Like they're not. It's not that they're so like fast that they're hard to play. But they're not just like dun 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 dun.
Yeah, they're not at all.
They're they're left-hand interesting, I suppose.
Yeah.
Not sorry. Yes, left hand.
Yeah.
So left hand, the hand on the on the frets,
yeah.
I suppose, is always doing something. It is an actual, like, there is a melody to the bass line as opposed to just the root note of whatever chord is playing.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, makes sense that they had like a funk influenced band as well, because anything funk influenced is like, what about that sweet bass?
Yeah, and Genius of Love has a ridiculous bass line.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a moment during this where she pulls a dance move that I think is the most delightful thing. It's like a weird spider dance. It looks kind of, dare I say, a little bit Zoidberg.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm in awe. I'm in awe. What a fucking icon to do that. And also, it just looks like the most fun thing to do. Because she's like, she didn't drop the bass and just start dancing around. She's sort of like...
No, dancing with the bass,
it's,
of course.
Oh, I love it. It's just... Like, if anyone's got a problem with that, or that level of joy, I think you just need to sort of not be allowed
to. It's fun to dance with your instruments. It is. Yeah. Like, I think it's
so liberating and free.
If you're standing up, this is my experience. I know there's lots of people who stand still while they play instruments, but if you're standing up, especially, I think sitting down, it's easier to stay still. It is hard to not even at least kind of like sway, you know, get some movement.
Yeah.
I remember years ago, I was playing piano or something, and I realized I was kind of like moving as I was playing, and I thought, in my head, oh, I'm that guy now. But it is like, you don't need to do full, like, you know, busted jumps in the air to do it, but there's a lot of joy there, and I like that it's a bit off, you know, like it's a bit unexpected. That's fun.
So they play the song, like, the end of the song, Chris Frantz says, we have to change back into the Talking Heads now.
Mm-hmm.
And they do, and then you get
Big suit.
The iconic image, possibly for the entire concept of the band.
For the band, I would say, yeah.
Because I reckon I could probably find more people who are aware of the big suit than they are of anything else. Like,
I would think so.
Because I was aware of the big suit.
I was wearing the big suit before I was even that aware of the songs of the band.
Yep.
I don't know. And I don't know when I became aware of the big suit.
It just sort of
like,
oh yeah, this guy
was
big suit.
Was a constant thing at some point in life. The obvious question is, like, when are you getting me a big suit? Obviously, so I can wear it all the time. I'm obsessed with the big suit.
Well,
so
when I get in contact with Gail Blacker, who made
the
big suit.
Who built the big suit.
Yeah, who built
the
it.
The word is built.
Yeah, it's definitely more of a construction than an item.
It
clothing.
Is, especially, I'll say this, especially the trousers.
Yeah.
Because they are so much wider than his waist, but they are staying up and allowing him a relatively high amount of freedom of movement. The jacket is kind of like, I'm sure there's a lot more construction to it, but it's the shoulders that are really doing a lot of the heavy lifting of the size, I would suspect.
Yeah.
But the trousers, like, to not feel, to still be able to move around in the way that he does, I suppose. I'm impressed by the construction.
Yeah.
I could talk about this big suit for a while. I won't, but I could.
Oh, no, yeah, that's absolutely fine. So
I'm really interested in the construction of the big suit.
Yeah, so you're not many miles off it, to be honest, in terms of...
The shoulders being the big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. So to describe the concept of the big suit, so in that sort of weird extra, that interview that I talked about earlier where David Byrne interviews himself, he's wearing the big suit as David Byrne.
Yeah.
And all the characters that are played by David Byrne, the character that asks him about the big suit is I can only describe it as his drag persona. I don't know what his drag name would be, but he is in drag when he asks this, and he does put on, it's very strange. This video is this video is basically Tim and Eric.
Perfect.
It's literally a Tim and Eric bit. I'm pretty certain they've actually said in interviews that actually influenced them.
We find out that this video led to the creation of Adult Swim or some shit.
It literally looks like it looks like.
I do need to watch
like,
this now.
I've linked it to you.
Beforehand.
It's,
oh man.
But basically he says, I like symmetry, geometric shapes. I wanted my head to appear smaller, and the easiest way to do that was to make my body bigger, because music is very physical, and often the body understands it before the head.
Nice. I like that.
Yeah.
That's good. And his head does look way smaller in the suit. That's what makes it so... It's not quite Uncanny Valley, but it gives you kind of a similar feel. Like, you're something just feels slightly off proportionally.
Yeah.
And you're like, huh.
Yeah.
Huh. All right.
There's a very amusing bit in Nathan For You where Nathan Fielder acquires a big suit for
something. Yes! And that's, it's the same thing.
It's literally the same thing.
Although, I will say, in my memory, Nathan Fielder looks more like a child in his father's suit.
He does.
Whereas David Byrne doesn't, but I think it's because because of the way the pants are built out.
Yeah.
It's more like his whole body kind of does fit the suit and it's just his head is small.
Yeah.
Which is slightly different than a really big normal suit being put on a smaller person, because then they look like a tiny baby in a suit.
Yeah.
It is different.
Gail Blacker is the person who made the suit, and I believe they described it to the New York Times as more of an architectural project than a clothing project.
Mm.
So, yes. Now, if you're wondering another reason why the big suit, it was described that she lined the three-button suit with needlepoint canvas to help it hold the shape and give it a degree of stiffness. The garments hung off Byrne and allowed him to dance freely, giant webbed shoulder pads and a girdle built into them so that from the side, the singer looks normal, but turning face would reveal his sumptuous girth.
That's interesting.
Yeah, he did tell Entertainment Weekly that most of the suit isn't touching you, it's just all hanging from the sort of like scaffolding. So it's,
yeah. I think you get that sense from the, when you do kind of see the jacket, because he takes off the jacket at a certain point as well, but like that there is clearly, like you say, the shoulders are taking most of the weight, because when he turns to the side, it's not like a cylinder.
Yeah.
It is just wide.
Yeah.
It's just wide.
As someone who's into costume and stuff.
Yes, that's why it's so interesting. And like as someone who can't sew very well, I can like only, it's one of those things I keep meaning to learn, how to make garments. But I'm really interested in the construction of garments and things. Like it is, like from a historical point of view and from a costuming point of view. And like it is interesting to think about, it's the movement. There is something about the fact that he can be so free moving within this skeleton, essentially.
Yeah.
I think like it's very memorable, it's very iconic.
It actually, on the cover of the soundtrack record, why a big suit is printed on the cover of it.
Nice.
Yeah. Also there are other ways to, in other sort of stuff about this, he does wear a layer of padding, which is like very soft. Now the suit doesn't actually stand up by itself, although it looks like it might. He only wears it during a brief period of the performance because, as
I think he wears it for one song even.
He wears it for about two or three. It's too hot for too long.
But that's what I mean. He keeps the trousers on for a bit longer, but he takes the jacket off actually fairly
swiftly.
Yeah, the
jacket goes off straight after the girlfriend is better.
That's what I mean. The full suit is only for one song, and he keeps the trousers on for a couple more songs.
Yeah.
That's how I could see that the trousers are actually wider than him, because he's not wearing the jacket covering it all.
Yeah, by the time you get to Cross-Eyed and Painless, then
it's gone. And then he does eventually just go back to normal clothes, because you couldn't.
Yeah, so the suit also was inspired by, Japanese theatre.
Oh, yeah.
As he will explain. A friend made a kind of quip while I was trying to think of what to do on this next tour, what to wear, and he said, well, you know what theatre is, everything has to be bigger. He didn't mean that the clothes had to be bigger. He meant that the gestures were larger, the music had to be more exaggerated on stage than they would be in real life. But I took it very literally and thought, oh, the clothes are bigger. I'd been in Japan recently and seen a lot of traditional Japanese theatre, and I realised that, yes, that kind of front-facing outline, a suit, a businessman's suit, looked like one of those things, a rectangle with just a head on top. He would then come to lament how closely identified he and the band had become with the suit. He told the writer Ian Gittins, that'll be the inscription on my tombstone. Here lies the body of David Byrne. Why the big suit?
Yeah. And look, my enthusiasm for the big suit is not helping. Like,
no.
It is, I'm feeding exactly into the thing that he's like, that's what happened. But I think it's just fun. I think it's fun. I think it works with those concepts that you've kind of laid out as the reasoning behind it. But it's also just, there is something about when you watch something on stage, you do just, like, yes, okay, we want to feel emotions. Oh, art is catharsis.
Oh my God.
But I just want to be interested also.
If I'd have seen this, if I was like 21 in 1984 and I'd gone to see the show and he comes out in a big suit, I'm not going to talk about anything else.
Exactly.
Because, like, the only thing I'm going to think of is why the big suit.
Why the big suit?
Not, oh, he was wearing a big suit. My first thing is, oh, why? Is this a comment on, like, suits just being cumbersome, nonsensical garments? Like, what is it? Like, Or is it just, lol, I'm wearing a big suit, aren't I hilarious? That's the thing.
Yeah.
I would have been, like, in the car.
We're asking questions.
Yeah, in the car, it's, back cut to wherever I was.
It's raising stuff inside of you. It's making you think.
The car drive home or to the hotel or whatever is just going to be me going, why the big suit? To whoever I'm in the car with, whether I'm driving, someone else driving. Like, that's all I'm going to be thinking about. Like, if there wasn't the big suit, I would have gone, why is he dancing with a lampshade? If it wasn't for that, I'm going to go, how much cocaine has he had? Like, I don't know. Like,
where does he get all his energy?
Yeah. You know, like, the performance of Girlfriend Is Better in particular, that's like, it, like, the song's going, and then he just seems to sort of, like, bop out in this big suit. Like, he didn't just walk on stage with it.
He's
just
bopping.
Like, there's this little dart, and then he's, like...
He's grooving.
It's just delightful. Like, I you just can't take your eyes off it.
No, that's what I mean. Yeah. It's compelling. Like, it draws the eye. There is something about in theatre, things need to be bigger. It's the thing I often struggled with. It's like why, of the theatre crafts, acting is the one I gave up the quickest when I was a kid. Because, like, I found it very hard to pitch. You have to be a bit bigger.
Yes,
you've got
to
play to the cheap seats.
Yes,
but
you
don't want to be so big that it doesn't make any sense. Yeah. You're just fully chewing the scenery.
Yeah.
And I always found that really challenging to do. I was like, what if I just sing songs instead? And that was my solution to the thing. But there is something when you're watching it about, and there is something about the context, like the fact that it is on like a theatre stage lends something that if it was in a stadium would probably be weird. If it was just straight filmed on a set might be weird. You know what I mean? Like, there is something, it all kind of melds in a way that works, I think.
Speaking of like how he feels about the big suit, so just as a little note to that, so we're recording this in 2023, in the year of our Lord 2023. The film distributor A24, who do a lot of like interesting films,
they've done some good shit in the last couple of years.
So they bought the rights to, I don't know if it's just the theatrical distribution rights or just like all of the rights to Stop Making Sense. They've bought the theatrical distribution rights. They filmed a funny little promo with David Byrne to sort of promote this, where basically he goes to a dry cleaner's to pick up, you guessed it,
Nice. That's also something I haven't watched in advance. God, I'm going to be watching some Talking Head shit later today.
It's just, it's just 40 seconds. It's just him going to a dry cleaner's picking up the big suit.
I'm excited for that to be released. It's going to be fun. I want to see it on the big screen.
Yeah. So, like, not saying that we've timed this so to...
No, you mentioned this before this came out. It's just the universe telling you that this meant to be.
Yeah.
Gotta talk about it.
So, the last couple of songs of the show, they do a version... They had recorded a version of Al Green's Take Me to the River on a previous record. The version they play here is just fucking incredible.
Yeah.
It's so
joyous. Yeah.
It's so goddamn joyous and fun. And the way they end the show with the... they end it with the song Cross-Eyed and Painless. And basically they play that song at like 1,000 miles per hour. That's not a slow song.
No.
But they play it at about 1,000,000,000 miles an hour. And it's very... Like, that's not a song where there's lots of, like, interesting chord progressions. It's, I almost want to say it's the same one fucking chord progression for, like, 7 minutes or something.
Yeah.
But it's so goddamn compelling. And, like, the vocal, the rhythm, it's... I mean, they really embraced, like, African rhythms.
Yeah.
In the two records around this time. They really went in on that. And that's really old. Like, it just becomes really obvious when you listen to the record. It's like, oh, of course, yeah. And the Cross-Eyed and Painless, like, I just want to, like, get up on a fucking sofa and just start, like, doing a terrible dance, because I'm not a very good dancer. I can keep a rhythm, but I can't actually do anything remotely spectacular.
I feel like keeping the rhythms after the battle, to be honest.
Yeah, like, you just want to lose your fucking mind. Like, that's the few times we cut to the crowd, and, yeah, they're all standing up. The whole crowd is standing up, just, like, do little head movements.
That's fun.
Yeah, it's just furious. It's so good. Chris Brown's is just smacking the shit out of the drums. Jerry Harrison's just killing it. Everyone's killing it.
Yeah.
Like,
everyone's firing on all cylinders in this whole show.
I know I said it earlier, but seriously, every musician on stage is just fucking destroying. This tour must have been fucking unbelievable every night, no matter whether it was in LA, like this in this video, or whether it's in New York, wherever. If you saw this tour, wherever you saw it, it was probably fucking insane. And it's just pure energy. It's not pure energy and skill. It's not... You know, as we mentioned, there's no pyro, there's no, like, excessive light show, there's no, just, they're relying almost entirely just on themselves. Like, the most intricate fucking stage stuff is, like, just the fucking drum riser. That is as complex as it really gets. And a big suit.
Yeah.
And a lampshade.
Yeah. But it's like, and yet it's not overly simple necessarily, but yeah. it does kind of show that things don't need to be super complicated yeah. or super massive or super expensive even
yeah.
to be compelling and to be affecting.
Yeah, I get that. But there's a little part of me thinks if a band performed the show now,
mm-hmm.
I think people would be like, oh, there wasn't really much of a show. They were just sort of on stage. Like, people would actually say that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because people, when they go see a big band, quote unquote, when they go see yeah. a show at a big venue, they want all the fucking LED fireworks and shit. Like, there is, I think, an expectation. And I do think there is one. Like, I think people, there are some folks who genuinely, they walk out of a show. And you hear it when you go out of a show. You hear mm-hmm. I hear it all the time.
I haven't been to shows in a while. So I trust your
whenever
judgment.
Whenever I go to a show, yeah. no matter what big size it is, I always see one person, if they ever create a rule, like, oh, there wasn't really much of a show. They're really good, but there wasn't really much of a show. I'm like, that is the show, you fucking idiot.
Yeah, I'm here to see the band.
The band is the show. Do you, what?
I've seen...
What?
I've seen shows
where... It's a criticism to me that makes no fucking yeah, sense on a
like, I've seen
level.
Shows that I can't... So, I can't remember what the exactness of that... And this is often shows in smaller venues. They might have a projector behind them. They might. But it is just them.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I don't know, somewhere between like 1 and 500... Yeah. Cat venue, it's small. Like, I remember seeing Oathbreaker. I don't think they had. They might have had some projections behind them.
I don't think they did.
I think they were just them, and it was yeah. amazing.
Yeah,
it's an amazing show.
Shame people couldn't quite understand that.
I mean,
need to shut the fuck up.
Yeah, you need to be quiet. But you know what I mean? Or like, I've seen.
Yeah, I'll never forget that.
A lot of shows I've seen in like, say, venues that are small. So like, say, like the Old Blue Last or something that's like smaller bands. But they've been great shows, like high energy shows. They don't have any effects necessarily, or they might have, like I say. Might have a light or two. They yeah. might have a projection in the back.
Yeah.
And they're great because yeah. the band is the show
yeah.
in my mind.
But I think if you don't go to shows like that very often,
mm-hmm.
you get, like, you do, it does seem to annoy people.
Yeah.
Not many, and but like, there is an expectation that a show means fireworks, LED screens, and
I'll
only
say,
that.
Like, I enjoy going to, like, a big show like Ghost, and I like their little skits.
Yeah.
I like when they bring out a fucking tricycle or some shit.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's fun. And it's fun to have big shows as well, but it's yeah. not, it's not necessary. Like, it's, if it serves what you're trying to get at, sure, but it
yeah.
shouldn't be a downside if people use like an old, like a lamp you might find in a nana's house kind of thing as their light source.
So, but I'm just merely commenting on
yeah,
the
yeah.
audience expectations.
No, but I think that's
in
interesting. I wasn't as aware of that because it's been pre-pandemic since I've been to a live show,
yeah.
whereas you've been to some live shows, so you have
yeah.
more of a sense of what people are expecting.
Yeah, there's always someone. It's never loads of people. There's always someone.
Do you think there's a genre element to that, or do you think that's across the board?
I think it's a mixture of things.
Okay. I'm just curious. Like, I don't know the answer or have a take on that.
I just find it's just a weird, interesting phenomenon that I never really understood. Like, because this happened,
mm-hmm.
just happened to me when I was young. Like, I see a band in... Put it this way, very rarely, like, a prominent band would come down to, say, Folkestone Town.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, half my fucking school would go.
Sure.
And half of the other schools would go. Like, that. Like, it would just be, you just know almost half the audience without even having
yeah,
to, like,
yeah.
arrange
I've
to
been to
anyone.
Shows like that, yeah.
But you would get people go, like, you'd hear, like, it used to be old people going, oh, wasn't really much of a show. I'm like, the band is the show, you fucking idiot.
Yeah.
Like,
but I'll say this, like, I think at a certain size of venue, you do need to, like, flesh it out a bit.
Yeah, but at the same time...
That's why people get their big screens.
Yeah, that's cool, but like, do something with it. Don't just
yes,
like,
do something with it.
Shit on
do
it
something with it. Yeah, yeah, of course.
Tie it into the show, or just don't bother. Yeah.
I mean, that was a tangent.
Yeah. No, it's a tangent, but it's important because, like, this is still regarded as one of, if not the best concert movie ever made by any, like, even at the time, critics fucking loved this movie. Like, your Roger Ebert, your Pauline Kael's, all the fucking, like,
the big
know,
names
serious
of
critics.
Yeah.
They all fucking love this movie. Like, I love this movie, partly because honestly, if I'd have seen this movie randomly when I was like 15, I would have probably dropped everything and started a band.
Yeah.
I'm not even joking.
Yeah, yeah, no, I remember that feeling. I remember being a teenager and
this movie makes,
particularly
this movie
like this.
Makes playing in a band look like
the most fun thing in the world. Yes, 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 yes.
That is the number one reason why I love
it. And
it
is. And that's the thing, like, playing with people is a lot of fun. And it's, you just really see it with them.
Yeah.
You really, because it is. I love playing with people, yeah. And performing with lots of people and stuff, and they just make it seem like
yeah.
the best crack. Yeah.
Fundamentally, this is a movie bound at the peak of their fucking powers. This is as good as it, literally as good as it gets for the Talking Heads. Like in terms of on everything that you will, there is no like other live thing where other actually they're a bigger commercial prospect. No, this is literally yeah. as big as it gets. Fundamentally, also. These performances were some of the last performances technically you could ever have seen before, because they didn't actually split up. They released not one but three more albums after, three more studio albums. Like the last studio album came out in 1988.
Yeah.
But
they weren't touring them?
No, they did not. David Byrne actually said in the weird 4-minute Adult Swim video, they'll tour, basically words to the effect of they'll tour again when he's got something, when they've got something new to say.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, he also says like the next project he's going to do is going to be story. There's going to be songs about stories from tabloid newspapers, which is a reference. I think he does that, but he doesn't do that next. There's another album, Little Creatures, 1985, that comes out first. Then he makes the film True Stories. So it's a film directed by David Byrne.
Amazing.
Starring John Goodman.
Nice. I love John Goodman.
No, I've never seen True Stories. I've listened to the record, which has songs from it, and it's delight. Like, I'm not going to say it's my favourite record, but Wild Wild Life is a fucking banger. I thoroughly recommend that. But yeah, it's... this film, like, the full on-screen title of the film is True Stories, a film about a bunch of people in Virgil, Texas. It's... I can't really describe it because it looks fucking mental. Apparently it is just a bit weird. That film basically doesn't happen if Stop Making Sense isn't a hit. Because
yeah.
they put a shitload of their own money into this. Like, if this had died in his ass, they would have been broke, possibly. Like, they bet big on this. They put a lot of cash into this. But yeah, this is basically the last time, realistically, for a lot of folks, this would be the last time that they would ever be able to see them. Because this is probably the biggest band that's never reunited.
Yes, yeah.
Like, I know I mentioned the sort of Bad Blood earlier. Like, to my knowledge, they didn't... David Byrne basically said that the band was over just in an interview. Like, that there wasn't like a, we're fucking done, but it very much, it's pretty acrimonious. Like, the last time they ever played together was, put it this way, I think the tour would have ended about 1984, right? They didn't play together live publicly until 2002, which was the induction for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That is the last time I think the four of them have been in the same room together, let alone play music. Like, I know they've randomly met. I'm pretty confident saying that concert promoters have tried to make it happen because...
I'm sure, yeah.
Everyone else has fucking done it at this point.
Yeah.
I think people have probably been trying to get them to reunite for probably 15, 20 years. It wouldn't surprise me if someone has tried to put an offer together in the last year. Mm. Even though, judging by what they've said about each other at various points...
That's not happening.
Brutal. I won't go into the details.
No, but
it's. I think this is the one reunion that just isn't going to happen. Like I. This is not happening.
And so do you know what we get instead? Theatrical release. Yeah. Start Making Sense
again. But it's pretty telling that the only person who seems to be involved in the marketing of this release is David Byrne.
Yeah.
Even just getting the four in the same room to say hi, come see this film again would be a big deal. Yeah, this film's incredible. Even if you're not really into like live movies, I'd still recommend just listening to the fucking album. Just listen to the album. It's incredible.
But it is fun.
Oh, it's so good.
Like, it's a particularly fun live movie to watch because I get it. Like, I also don't necessarily want to sit down and watch live concerts all the time. Like, there'd be something would need to really compel me towards that.
Yeah.
But this is great.
Yeah.
This is a lot of fun.
This is fucking brilliant. Talking Heads fucking slap.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd end on that. I want to end on a slightly positive note. A slightly more positive note, sorry. This film's incredible. If you haven't seen it before, you are in for a treat. If you're seeing it before it around the time it's going to come out, if you're listening to this before it comes out theatrically, if it comes anywhere near you, absolutely go see it theatrically. 100%. All
big
right.
Big suit on the big screen.
Big suit, big screen, big
dreams. Even bigger.
Bigger.
This is an audio medium, but I keep putting my hands out really wide when I say big suit.
Do you know what you want to do next time, or you want to surprise me?
I'm going to stay in the world of the music of the mid-1980s.
Okay.
And I'm going to talk about, because I mentioned her several times in my last episode, I want to talk about the album Hounds of Love by Kate Bush.
Very good. Excellent. Nice bit of Bush.
Oh, you're going to keep making that joke when I'm doing the episode, aren't you? I take it back!
We're going to go to Bush Gardens. That's a theme park. That's not a sex joke.
I have never heard of that. So.
It's in America.
I don't know. I've never been to America. I don't know what's going on there. I know what's going on in London and Ireland.
I mean, it's no Tato Land, but Bush Gardens
but
is a real place.
But what is, Louis? It's not going to be Tato Land for much longer.
No, Big Suit.
Anyway.
It's going to be Big Suit Land.
If only. That's my new theme park.
David Byrne's Irish Utopia.
That's my new business endeavour.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You were listening to the Darling Why podcast presented by Louis Tangarides and Kate Stewart. If you liked what you heard, please feel free to give us a follow at Darling Why Podcast on Instagram. Feel free to rate and subscribe on whatever podcast feed you're listening to. This podcast is produced, edited, and put together entirely by Louis Tangarides and Kate Stewart. Thanks for listening. See you next time.